Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, expert advice on sports-related concussions.
If we recognize a concussion, if we treat the person properly, in almost all cases, we can prevent some of the long-term problems that you may be hearing about.
Plus, we'll discuss implications of the Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa.
You know, it's all about infrastructure, and certainly the Ebola outbreaks that are occurring in the African countries, in large part is blamed on the lack of infrastructure there.
And a conversation about the life and controversial work of psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Szasz.
He thought that suicide was a liberty interest that everybody had. It was their life to dispose of as they saw fit. That was their prerogative under certain conditions.
We'll get our checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll hear more about the Ebola virus wreaking havoc in West Africa and the likelihood of its spreading to our shores. Plus, we'll explore the life and controversial work of local psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Szasz and his powerful impact on the field of psychiatry. But first, sports-related concussions and how to keep your student-athletes safe. Concussions and the potential for subsequent brain injury is on the mind of many parents today, especially with the start of school year and fall sports. There's been much attention to the hundreds of thousands of sports-related concussions in this country, ranging from the high-profile NFL players with traumatic brain injury to fears of what these repeated head injuries might be doing to our children while they engage in sports like football and soccer. And here with more on this is Dr. Brian Rieger. He's the director of the Upstate Concussion Center. Welcome, Brian. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Linda. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to see you. So this continues to be of great concern, so much so that all 50 states now have sports concussion laws, including New York. Explain that to us. Tell us about that.
Well, certainly over the last several years, there's been a lot of attention paid to sports concussion, and I think there's been a recognition that with the prevalence of this condition, there needed to be more work done to make sure that we protected our kids. And the real focus has been on educating people about what the right way to manage a concussion is. Because if we do that properly, if we recognize a concussion, if we treat the person properly, in almost all cases, we can prevent some of the long-term problems that you may be hearing about.
Isn't it really important because it's the proper management of concussion, as you said, could really reduce the duration and the severity of the symptoms going forward?
I think that's the belief of many people who work in this field of concussion and have seen the cases where an athlete was either hiding symptoms or was not managed properly, and it seems that there's an increased risk in those cases of more prolonged and severe symptoms affecting their schoolwork or their ability to participate in sports, et cetera.
So just help us understand very briefly what the guidelines are, particularly in New York State.
Right, and they're pretty simple and pretty consistent across the states, which is that in the event of a suspected concussion, it's imperative that an athlete immediately be removed from the practice or game, and in fact be removed from any activity where there could be an increased risk of head injury. And it's a pretty simple idea. When the brain is hurt, it's more vulnerable to being hurt again. So we want to wait until it's recovered before we allow that person to go back to risky activities.
So is there a prescribed time frame in terms of how long someone has to be taken out of these activities? And are there other activities, that ancillary activities, such as schoolwork or things that require mentation or heavy thinking that would also be prohibited or limited?
Yes. The first step is if someone on the sidelines, and there's not always a medical person on the sidelines, but let's say a coach or someone is suspicious, they pull that person out. The first step is get that medical evaluation. And maybe there's not a diagnosis of concussion and it's safe for the person to go back. But if there is a diagnosis of concussion, then that kicks in a pretty standard protocol where we're going to keep an eye on that athlete, we usually expect that the symptoms can worsen in the first few days, so we really want to pay attention. There's a growing sense that maybe we should keep these kids out of school for a day or two automatically just to really let them rest. We don't want to have them be out of school too long, certainly no longer than necessary, but perhaps resting that brain aggressively early on helps. Then we're going to wait till the symptoms have resolved or gone away while they're resting, and then we gradually introduce them back to physical and mental activity. If the symptoms don't come back during that period, that's when it's safe for them to go back.
Why is it so hard for it to be diagnosed? I remember you told in an earlier interview I had with you that concussions so often can be missed because it's hard to diagnose. Help us understand that.
This is a huge frustration to those of us working in the area of concussion. We have no medical test that diagnoses a concussion. It still relies on signs and symptoms. So we see a person gets hit, we see a person's in a car accident or whatever happens, and we really are just taking a good history, listening to what they describe about how they feel, and then making a determination that the person has had a concussion or not. But so, the symptoms are not specific to a concussion, so that can be a difficult call to make sometimes.
So that things like CT scans, which we often rely on for so many other types of things, really doesn't show a concussion.
That's an excellent point. The reason that CT scans are done is to determine whether the injury is more severe than a concussion, whether there's bleeding or swelling or a skull fracture that would warrant neurosurgical intervention. But in the vast majority of cases, a CT scan is normal. And as a matter of fact, there's a growing effort to try to reduce the use of CT scan, especially in children, because of the amount of radiation that's involved in those scans. So if you're a parent out there and your kid has a concussion and they go to the emergency room, oftentimes you want that CT scan done to reassure you, but the doctors may be telling you that we don't think it's needed, and actually it's probably better for your child if we don't do it. So be prepared that you may hear that now.
I could see why parents would be alarmed at that on both sides of the discussion.
Yes.
There are also some myths around concussion, the idea that you need to have blacked out in order for you to have sustained a concussion, or that everyone gets better within a two-week period, or once the headache leaves, all is well. So it seems like people need to, especially the people around kids in sports, need to understand very clearly what these symptoms are and what they mean.
Yes, and that's a good point. So only 10% of athletes actually lose consciousness. So yes, definitely most do not. And there have been some studies. I just did a talk for some soccer parents, and one of the studies I found preparing for that showed that soccer athletes, high school soccer players who had some education about concussion were twice as likely to report their symptoms to their coach as those who didn't have education. So there's a lot we don't understand and don't know about concussion, but we do know that if we give people the right education, we have a better chance of recognizing those injuries and working together to manage them properly.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Brian Rieger, and we're talking about concussion and what's being done to diminish the hazardous effects of it. I mean, one of the things you told me many times we've talked is the fact that many kids don't recognize that they've had a concussion, even kids and even coaches, and that leads to the problem. And it's not limited just to the classic high school football players, that it's permeating all through sports today. Tell us about that.
Yes, you know, the symptoms of a concussion can be quite varied. Everything from headache, which is the most common symptom, to vision problems. My daughter plays soccer, and a player on her team was telling her that she saw circles in her eyes after she got hit on the head. That was one of the symptoms that she had. And that's not necessarily something that a high school person might know could possibly be a symptom of concussion. So again, I think while it can be difficult sometimes to sort it out, there is a pretty typical set of symptoms that everybody should have some awareness about.
But more and more kids are being exposed as we play. You know, you have youth soccer now. I mean, it's not limited to just that high school football player on the defensive linebacker. I mean, you know, we need to look across the board. Wasn't there some interesting statistics recently that suggested that now more soccer is contributing as much?
Well, high school football and girls soccer together contribute to more concussions at the high school age than other sports. So the most of the concussions come from those sports.
And that's the recent, most recent data we
have. Yes, and that's probably because of the popularity of those sports amongst boys and girls, but also the risk. But again, my daughter plays soccer. I was just at a game last night, so I'm not suggesting that we need to not play sports. Quite the contrary. I think sports have a lot of value, but especially in youth sports. So we have these laws, but these laws apply primarily to scholastic sports. In youth sports, there are still very little guidelines, very little mandated education.
So when you say youth sports, you're talking about sports that take place outside of the aegis of a school.
Correct.
And they could be something like Little League, for
example?
Correct.
Little League or Pop Warner football, or in this area, certainly youth lacrosse leagues,
youth
soccer leagues. Exactly.
So parents really need to be aware of this and, you know, basically prepare their coaches, insist that their coaches really, or someone, a trainer or someone, really is apprised of the significance of potential concussion.
Yes. I mean, at youth sports, there's rarely a medical professional like a trainer.
So what about what exactly happens to the brain once there's been a concussion? What I mean is, I'm not asking you for, you know, data in terms of what's actually physiologically happening, but in terms of what are the effects on a brain that where maybe it's not being recognized? What are the short-term effects, mm-hmm. and then what are the longer-term effects?
So a concussion's a brain injury caused by a blow or a jolt to the head, and there's multiple ways that the brain is affected. The neurochemistry of the brain is affected, the blood supply to the brain can be affected, and the microstructural architecture of the brain, the actual fibers of the brain, can be affected. And in most cases, this is a transient effect that resolves within about a week or two in the vast majority of cases. But we have so much more sensitive ways of looking at the brain now that we're really beginning to understand how complicated these injuries can be, and also how it's possible that the brain can be affected even when the hit to the head doesn't actually produce a concussion.
We really?
Call these subconcussive events. And there's a lot of interest now, not only in concussion, but what might be the effects of accumulated trauma to the brain. So let's say you play a season of football and you take multiple hits to the head, but you don't actually suffer a concussion. Is there some risk associated with that? There have been studies with professional football players in particular that have raised concerns about the effects of repeated head trauma.
You know, leading to things long-term like dementia, ALS, Parkinson's, that kind of thing.
Yes, all of those have been suggested. It's certainly too early to know exactly what those relationships are, but I certainly think that we have enough information to know that we need to do more research into this area, and a lot is beginning to happen there.
How about kids in school who've had, let's say, played a season of football or play a season of soccer and may or may not sustain some, like you said, have more of these subconcussive events? Are we likely to see issues with learning problems, impulse control, that kind of thing? What's been your experience?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think in the cases where we don't actually meet the threshold for a concussion, I think in a younger child, we're still a ways from being able to say that that's going to produce these problems. Parents may certainly worry about that. They may attribute changes in their child to some of these things. But I think right now, I think we're more concerned about people who take repeated hits over a sustained career than at this point we are, say, one season of high school sports. But we do know that the developing brain, such as in high school, may be more vulnerable. So I'm just going to keep saying that it's a little too early to answer that question. There's a lot of people concerned about it. But right now, we certainly aren't able to draw that connection.
So bottom line, what's the takeaway?
I think the most important thing is that if we properly recognize and manage concussion, and if we do what we can do to help prevent concussion, proper education about avoiding dangerous play, about, you know, educating coaches and athletes what the symptoms are, I think in most cases we're going to get through this without problems. And certainly if there are questions, call our clinic and we'll...
Yeah, very briefly, in the very little bit of time we have left, what does your clinic offer?
So at the Upstate Concussion Center, we offer education and treatment, and we are also involved in some research about concussions. So certainly we treat people. We tend to see complicated cases, cases where there have been multiple concussions. We often have parents coming in with that question, should I let my child go back to play this sport? And there aren't clear answers always, but we try to educate people and help them make an informed decision. And when needed, we have a multidisciplinary team that offers comprehensive treatment for those complicated cases.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for coming in. As always, it's a pleasure to hear you, look at, you know, talk to you, and learn all that you have to offer. My guest has been Dr. Brian Rieger. He's the director of the Upstate Concussion Center. Next up, Ebola. Should we worry about it spreading to our shores? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, Dr. Kent Brandley and Nancy Reitbol, the two American aid workers who contracted Ebola in Liberia during one of the worst outbreaks that the continent has seen, returned to the United States for treatment in Atlanta Hospital, prompting many to fear that this could bring the deadly virus to our shores. Well, here with more on this is Dr. Timothy Endy. He's the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Endy. Thank you very much for having me. So these two patients were brought to the United States, and a lot of precautions were taken to try to keep them isolated. Why are these precautions so crucial in terms of Ebola?
Well, in part, the outbreak that's occurring in the three countries in Africa right now, and it's been known historically that Ebola is contagious, and it's spread by human-to-human contact, especially from infected body fluids. Which could be, for example, vomit or bleeding. And so that the precautions are needed to prevent the spread to the healthcare providers who are taking care of them.
Let's start with, I think a lot of people are kind of bandying the term about Ebola, but what exactly is Ebola?
Well, Ebola is a virus, and it's in a family of viruses called the filoviruses. Their genetic code is consisting of RNA or ribonucleic acid. And so it's an RNA virus, and it has a very distinctive morphology. It's a long, thin virus with a characteristic curve at the end of it called a shepherd's crook. So that when you see it under a high-powered microscope, like an electron microscope, the features are very distinctive for the filoviruses. There are several, I think there are five or six strains of Ebola virus, named from the countries where they're isolated, like Zaire. And then there's a close cousin of Ebola called Marburg, which also produces a very similar set of symptoms and hemorrhagic disease, as well as very responsible for some very well-known large outbreaks in Africa.
Do we know where it came from?
No one's quite sure, and there's been a lot of investigations. There's one particular cave in Zaire that was investigated from an outbreak that where they've never really found a source, though it's been isolated from a particular bat called a fruit bat from Africa, and they think that that might be the reservoir for this virus.
So it had jumped from animal to human, which not all viruses do, and now basically once it's jumped to humans, human to human contact is the way it's being spread.
Correct.
So why is it so deadly? I read somewhere it kills 50 to 90% of its victims.
Well, it's a very what we call pathogenic virus. And what's characteristic of a lot of viruses that do what you described as jump from one species to another, the virus's whole goal is actually to adapt to that particular host. So killing the host doesn't really do the virus very much service in its ability to transmit and propagate. So in a reservoir host, like in a fruit bat, for example, they don't become sick or die from the virus. The virus actually is replicating.
They're just a carrier.
Just a carrier. But when they jump to another species, they're not well adapted, and they produce a lot of tissue and organ damage, and that results in the severity of the symptoms and also the high mortality. Rabies virus is a great example of that. There's a reservoir in bats, for example, but when it goes into humans from the bite or saliva of that reservoir host, then the mortality is like near 100%.
Wow. So what causes death? What actually leads to someone to die from Ebola?
Well, there's such tremendous cell and tissue damage that there's organ failure. So kidney failure, liver failure, because of all the tissue destruction that goes on. And so death is by those organs not being able to function very well. Plus, it causes a hemorrhagic disease, so you're not able to clot your blood as well, and you bleed out into the gastrointestinal tract and can die from bleeding.
So right now, do they really understand how it's transmitted? I've read many, many things in the news they're talking about. It's transmitted, you know, basically bodily fluids and direct contact. But these two workers, for example, that were in Africa, were covered and were wearing hazmat suits, I would think, and taking precautions. Do we really understand fully how this disease is transmitted?
Well, I think there's still a lot of questions that we don't understand about transmission. We do know that body fluids are infected and can be transmitted to humans through splashing the eye, the mucous membranes, through needle sticks and such. In these two particular patients, it's not really clear. I'm not familiar with what the circumstances were,
right,
how they got infected. But I think, you know, you have to understand the conditions that they're working on in these countries. It's very primitive. Even though they are wearing containment type clothing, it's probably 110 degrees there. They're sweating profusely. There's no air conditioning. They're overtired. There's fatigue. There's a lot of chaos going on. You can probably imagine some breaks in procedures that results in infection.
So that it's not clear whether it was a breakdown. It's more likely that there was a breakdown in procedure or in prevention that caused them to become infected, is what you're postulating, rather than some unknown source or reason for transmission.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would, you know, guess. I can imagine they're probably working 14, 15-hour days, and your concentration level and your procedures can take a hit at the end of a long day.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with infectious disease expert Dr. Timothy Endy, and we're talking about Ebola. Well, you've had a very special history with Ebola. Tell us about that.
Well, I had the privilege of being the head of virology at the United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Disease, which is located at Fort Detrick in the early 2000s. Fort Detrick is a high-level containment laboratory. It's called the BO4 lab. Richard Preston wrote a book about it called The Hot Zone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's where you wear the blue suits and the air cables and all that. And my division was in charge of developing vaccines and therapeutics and understanding the pathogenesis of Ebola, Marburg, and some other nasty viruses, once called Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. So I had the opportunity to be in the lab and, you know, work on projects with Ebola.
Was any progress made during the time you were there in terms of either talking about developing a vaccine or treatment protocols?
There's a lot of progress. There is a number of candidate vaccines that showed very good promise in non-human primate studies.
But not yet. And that was the other point that I wanted to bring out, is that these two individuals who were brought here were given some kind of a treatment that was more of a experimental treatment, this ZMAT mm-hmm. product that I guess is in development. And does that suggest that we're closer to more effective treatment for something like Ebola, or even to develop prevention like a vaccine?
Well, I think there are a number of different candidate vaccines that have shown some preliminary promise in animal studies for protection. I'm not familiar with the ZMAP product in itself, though I know it's a monoclonal antibody that's very specific for the Ebola virus. And antibodies been used historically. For example, the Russians have been using hyperimmune globulin, which is a concentrated immune globulin for the treatment and protection of Ebola. But the data from that is kind of iffy in terms of how protective it is.
So we're not quite there yet. And we don't even know if this CMAT really has had an influence or whether the people are just recovering on their own with...
That's right. You know, it hasn't been done in a controlled fashion. It's the, you know, the subject size is two people. But certainly from what you hear on the news, it sounds very promising.
So in this era of global travel and era of global diseases, therefore, I mean, anything is a plane ride away from coming to our shores. At one point, I talked to you many years ago about dengue, and at that time, dengue had just started showing itself on the continental United States, and it had been other places, third world countries before that. So we are all really an international or global community these days. What should we be doing, or could we be doing, and why is it the case that we don't need to fear perhaps the spread of these diseases here in the United States? What's in place here?
Well, you know, it's all about infrastructure, and certainly the Ebola outbreaks that are occurring in the African countries in large part is blamed on the lack of infrastructure there. So, you know, we in the United States are privileged to have a very well organized and functional public health system. We have just outstanding standards of health care delivery, and
we know also how to isolate and quarantine and prevent the spread of these kinds of diseases once they're identified.
That's true. But not to to be overly optimistic, you know, we are still vulnerable. And I can tell you numbers of examples. West Nile is a great one, right? Where it was introduced in New York City and within a matter of 5 years spread through the entire continental United States, producing thousands of deaths. Mm. So West Nile is an example of how vulnerable we are to these pathogens that can arrive from a traveler that goes from Africa to Syracuse, New York in about 30 hours by airplane. And it's happened, and it's happened before. You know, we here at Upstate, we treat 12 to 15 cases of severe malaria a year, and these are from all travelers who come out of endemic countries with malaria.
So what would happen, or what does happen, when someone comes to the ED with these kinds of symptoms where you worry about either malaria or something like Ebola? What actually takes place?
Well, first is recognition, you know, asking the right questions and then recognizing what potentially could be some serious infection that's causing the patient's problem. The second is if it's contagious. Certainly the ED is well set up in Upstate, has the facilities for the proper isolation of patients, and then the infection control practices to protect the healthcare providers from becoming infected in the process.
And in the past, in these circumstances that you've alluded to, you were able to contain the problem.
Sure. You know, we have naturally contagious infections as well in Onondaga County, tuberculosis being one of them. And we get TB patients all the time. And there are isolation procedures and special masks that we wear to protect ourselves.
I mean, there's been talk about SARS, avian flu, many of these types of things mm-hmm. have been threats. And yet, what you're seems to be underscoring is that with the right public health measures and the right infection control within institutions and within the public at large, much of that can be forestalled.
Absolutely. But the very first critical step is recognition. And that can be a very important critical step.
And it sounds like right now in this country, they are testing people before they get on planes from those three countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. And they're also being tested when they get here. So we are taking those precautions in terms of who's showing up with potential symptoms.
Yes.
And as we said, you're only spreading the disease when you're symptomatic?
There is a symptomatic period with fever, but you're probably spreading the disease several days before the onset of the severe symptoms because the virus is actually in your blood. So probably just before the symptoms, and then for probably several weeks after the symptoms have gone away, you might be still infected, being able to transmit the infection.
Well, I appreciate all this, insight and hopefulness that we are in good shape in this country and clearly here in this region. And I want to thank you so much for coming in and hopefully allaying some of our fears. My guest has been Dr. Timothy Endy, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's Checkup from the Neck Up, the coolest psychologist name ever, or Dr. Zygarnik meets Star Trek. Well, folks, long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, a psychologist named Dr. Zygarnik, sounds like she's from the Klingon realm, doesn't it? Anyway, she asked Earthlings to do a task and either interrupted them or not. And the next day, asked them what they were thinking about. She discovered that the minds of those interrupted were left with unfinished business that distracted their attention, like an invisible tractor beam pulling them back to the unfinished task, saying, "Finish me off, finish me off." And, dear listeners, long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, a psychologist named Dr. Rich O'Neill, sounds like he's from the Irish Federation, doesn't it? Used to sleep like a babykins. But when Scotty transported him from the distant past into the now, Rich discovered he wakes in the middle of the night sometimes, distracted from sleeping by worrying about unfinished business. And, dear listeners, from a star date relatively recent, other researchers from the land of Freud, whose last names are all Fudd, spelled PhD, Fudd, discovered that even if we can't finish a task, the earthling mind calms down to concentrate again once a specific battle plan is made for what to do on that unfinished task. So now this Rich O'Neill Fudd gives himself about 15 minutes to go back to sleep, but if that doesn't work, he gets up, writes down the problem and the specific realistic action battle plan, and it seems to work. Usually, his alleged mind can rest easier. He finds it even better if he gets up and actually finishes the job. Same thing at work. If he's distracted by an asteroid belt of minutiae, emails and mail, et cetera, obscuring the Fuddship USS O'Neill's path to his major mission, he clears those little jobs up, doing some, filing some, jettisoning some, and then can fire his maximum force attention phasers on the Klingon warship. Fire, Mr. Sulu, fire! Yes, Captain Fudd, fire! Enemy finished off, Captain. Thank you, Mr. Zulu. I'm Dr. Rich, Captain Fudd O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up next, the controversial contributions of psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Szasz to how we view mental illness. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of September 15th. Meet me halfway. The average American's diet contains too many solid fats, saturated fats, and bad cholesterols, which are all found in animal products. Experts therefore recommend limiting total meat intake to 2-3 ounce servings a day or less. Now remember, 3 ounces is about the size and width of a deck of cards or the palm of your hand. Aim to eat less meat this week. Have a meatless Monday. Skip sausage and bacon at breakfast. Or cut your lunch and dinner portions in half. Remember that you can easily stay full and cut the fat and calories by filling the space on your plate with fruits, vegetables, beans, and whole grains. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Dr. Thomas Szasz was a psychiatrist and an academic, a fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and a member of the American Psychoanalytic Association. He was born in Hungary in 1929 and came to the United States at the age of 9. He went on to train as a psychiatrist, and he served as a professor of psychiatry at the Upstate Medical University from 1956 until he retired in 1990. He died in 2012, but throughout his career, he was known as a social critic of the moral and scientific foundations of psychiatry. And those are outlined in his widely read books, The Myth of Mental Illness and The Manufacture of Madness. We'll hear with more on all of this are Dr. Robert Daly and Dr. Chetan Haldapour, both emeritus professors of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Daly, let me start with you. You both knew Dr. Szasz. What sort of a man was he?
Well, he was very gracious, a gentleman of a European style, could be very charming. He was a teacher of mine and a clinical teacher as well as a seminar teacher. He was a superb clinical psychiatrist, I felt, was a great help to me in my formation as a psychiatrist. He, on the public platform, he could be quite provocative and at times angry and formidable. And in the public sphere, he was a professional controversialist, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that strikes me as I began to research some of his work. Dr. Haldapour, he was so controversial. He took a really radical stance in this book, The Myth of Mental Illness, a radical stance about the whole existence of mental illness. Help us understand what he was saying.
Well, it is true that his book was highly controversial when it was first published. As you know, the book got translated into many European languages and also Japanese, if I remember right, and Chinese. In the book, he argued that if mental illness does not have, we do not have any biological basis. So if there's no biological basis for any disorder, it shouldn't be considered as a disease. That was the kernel of his argument. I mean, we can elaborate that in many different ways.
So let me get this straight. Mm-hmm. So when you say there's no biological foundation for it, is it that there were no objective methods for detecting the presence or absence of mental illness the way perhaps we would, with a brain scan, find something like Alzheimer's or something of that nature?
Precisely. Many of the so-called mental diseases have not we have not established any etiology in the brain. And if we were to, then he would argue that they would be considered as neurologic problems and not psychiatric problems.
So what did he think of these kinds of behaviors that were sometimes shocking, sometimes disturbing? Dr. Daly, the conduct that we see in some severe forms of what we call mental illness, like schizophrenia, how did he explain it?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between knowing that someone is mentally ill or crazy and knowing why. And Dr. Haldapour was mentioning a biological basis. Well, that has to be a biological basis of something to even start the conversation. So his view was, and I think you used an interesting term, conduct. When we use that term, we usually think of someone authorizing an action. And Dr. Zas thought that a great many of the symptoms and activities of people who were judged to be mentally ill, they were in fact conducting themselves, but in ways that we didn't approve of. And that's why we locked them up or forced them into treatment, or what we called treatment, or something of that sort.
So a corollary to that was that the psychiatry and the mechanism, the state mechanism of psychiatry, in some ways was attempting to control people.
Exactly. He thought it was psychiatry was a system of social control, largely under the aegis of the state.
And he used the term the therapeutic state.
Yes, that was one, the title of one of his books.
So there was really this idea that that the state and science, under the guise of psychiatry, I think he even talked about that psychiatry was a pseudoscience in this sense. It wasn't true science because of the fact that there was no proven biological basis for some of these disease
states.
Yes,
that's what he argued, yes, correct.
So where did some of these ideas come from? I mean, he was somewhat libertarian, it sounds to me, and some other principles that informed these ideas. It seemed to me that he felt that people had self-ownership was a major concept here. Tell us about that, Dr. Haldapour.
Well, he truly was a libertarian in the strict sense of the term. He believed that every human being had a right, but with rights come responsibilities. So whatever the acts may be, the person had a right to do whatever he or she wants to, but they had to be held responsible for that. And that's one of the kernels of his philosophy, that not only people were free to do what they wanted to, but they should be held responsible for it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with psychiatrists Dr. Chetan Haldapour and Dr. Robert Daly. And we're talking about the legacy and the work of psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Zas. So some of this whole concept, Dr. Haldapour, that you mentioned, led him to some very controversial positions, specifically on something like suicide, which obviously the state has suggested, or our common culture is, that we want to prevent suicide whenever possible. He argued differently, right, Dr. Daly?
That's correct. He thought that suicide was a liberty interest that everybody had. It was their life, and their life to dispose of as they saw fit. And if that included suicide, that was their prerogative under certain conditions. On the other hand, I was at a meeting one time when someone asked him what he would do if he was in his office and the patient wanted to jump outside and commit suicide.
Jump out of a window.
Jump out of a window. And he said, I would call security.
Okay, that's kind
My office is not a suicide center. So while he was argued that suicide was a liberty interest, that didn't mean that you could commit it in just any setting at all, particularly his office.
That's interesting. That's kind of mm-hmm. a little dicey there. Would you agree?
Yeah.
So there were some other things, other principal points that grew out of this idea. For example, wasn't he opposed to involuntary hospitalization, which was a huge, huge factor that was going on at the time?
Correct. He believed that the treatment ought to be entirely voluntary. Surgeons don't go in and operate without the consent of patients. Internists don't do that. Why do psychiatrists involuntarily treat patients? Again, it gets to the point we were making earlier about agency, as Dr. Daly was talking about, and freedom to choose or not to choose any form of treatment. He wasn't opposed to, as I understood him, opposed to treatment per se, but he was opposed to involuntary treatment.
So that a hospital would become a prison, so to speak.
Exactly. And he saw those who treated involuntarily, he saw them as agencies of the state rather than of the person. And that's the difference here. And that's why he argued against involuntary treatment. At the same time, he was opposed to what we refer to as insanity defense for the same reason. That
explain that further.
You couldn't argue that somebody perpetrated an act because he or she was schizophrenic. That was not an excuse, that the person ought to be held responsible for his or her actions.
I'm curious, do you know if he, this is just came into my head, would he then be in support of something like the death penalty, or do you not know?
I'm not sure whether he wrote anything about the death penalty.
I don't recall.
But just in terms of the idea of agency and responsibility for one's mm-hmm. actions.
Well, he was a big supporter of, in many ways, of the law.
Mm-hmm.
So that the idea that you could, that anything goes was not an idea that he supported. It was that you were responsible for what you did, but that you needed to act within the confines of the law and in the exercise of your prerogatives, not engage in activities that harm other people. He was very explicit about that.
And yet he was opposed to this concept of the war on drugs, that he felt that we should have a drug-free environment, that people, once again, with this notion that you're taking responsibility for your own actions, you should be able to...
Correct. He thought
take heroin.
He thought that all physicians should be in, and so to speak, an advisory role with regard to the patient, that the power of the prescription pad was a form of infantilizing the patient, so to speak. And, we can buy guns, we can buy chainsaws. He thought that we ought to have the same kinds of prerogatives with regard to all drugs.
So if you were to look at his legacy at this point in time, what would you say? I mean, what would your overriding point be at this point? How did he impact the field of psychiatry, the practice of psychiatry, mental health or illness for that matter?
I would say that, interestingly enough, his impact on practice, his on immediate practice, was probably greatest in Syracuse, New York. And I would say more generally that his influence, I would say he influenced from a distance psychiatric practice, not always in the direction that he sought, but he influenced in terms of reintroducing into psychiatry the idea of the person as an agent, as somebody who did things and had a right to do things, and as Dr. Haldeport says, was responsible.
How about you, in the little bit of time we have left, what would you say his legacy was?
Well, I think I compared the laws concerning involuntary treatment in most states, and most of us would suggest or believe that it was Dr. Zazi's influence that some of the laws have been tightened. It's no longer possible just to pick up somebody and admit him or her to a mental hospital.
Against their will.
Against their will. And I believe that he did substantially influence some of the laws.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
And suicide, he's had no effect on that, really.
Not, I don't believe so, yeah.
Because I think our culture generally mm-hmm. prizes mm-hmm. life
yeah.
to that degree. Mm-hmm. He was a fascinating character and clearly, you know, very, very large ideas. And I want to thank you both for coming in and sharing some of your perspective on him, both personally and from a professional standpoint. Thanks so
thank
much.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
My guests have been Dr. Chetan Haldeport and Dr. Robert Daly. They're both emeritus psychiatrists at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Suicide has a horrible rippling effect, not only the horror of losing that one life, but the waves of grief and guilt and anger the suicide unleashes over those who loved that person. poet Bruce Bennett from Aurora, New York, attempts to understand the subject in two poems. The first poem comes from Muse 6. It is called Sign Language. You showed me on your wrist small lines I would have missed, thin scars that scored your skin, but would not let me in to what was cracked and broken, to what remained unspoken. A few years later, Bruce returned to this subject, and this time created a sonnet. He calls it The Hug. Her hair was black. She looked young and alive. I knew that what she needed was a hug and gave it to her. We just stood there hugging. I didn't try to ask her any questions. I seemed to feel her presence was enough. It felt so good. I'd never dreamed about her, and it's been years. So that was all there was. I know it sounds too simple when I say it, but afterwards, you know, when I woke up and thought about it, how she looked and felt, it was like I had somehow solved the puzzle. We'd all been searching, wondering all that time, perplexed and angry. Why? How could she do it? She did it. What she needed was a hug.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn about a new drug to prevent HIV/AIDS and explore a one local doctor's battle with dengue fever. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.